Restaurant Unstoppable, episode 1078, with Jeff Good.
You know, nobody goes in a restaurant to shop. They buy, but they may never come back. So, you know, I think it's important that restaurateurs, we need to see that.
Are you ready for it factors, success stories, failures, and bombs of restaurant industry knowledge? Then, join Eric Cacciatore and today's incredible guest as they share what it takes to become unstoppable.
This episode brought to you by Owner.com. Owner.com is the leading all-in-one platform for restaurant marketing. Owner.com powers everything from SEO-optimized websites, direct online ordering, automated email and text marketing, built-in loyalty programs, zero-commission delivery, and branded mobile apps for your restaurant that's integrated right into your POS. With Owner.com, there's no contract, no hidden fees, and nothing to lose. Join thousands of restaurant owners using Owner.com to grow direct online sales, save thousands in third-party fees, and simplify their online ordering presence all in one. Book a free demo today at owner.com/unstoppable and see why owner.com is the number one rated restaurant marketing software. This episode is brought to you by Mies. With Mies, you can standardize your culinary IP and stay in sync, giving the culinary team the ability to both create recipes and distribute them from the same platform. You can train your team quickly and maintain dish consistency by turning your recipes into interactive training material, and you can get laser accurate food costs because Mies allows you to calculate the yield of ingredients with prep loss included. Create a free account by visiting getmeez.com/unstoppable. That's getmeez.com/unstoppable. And as a listener of Restaurant Unstoppable, you can get 25 recipes uploaded to your Meez account for free. Sign up today and learn more at getmeez.com/unstoppable. This episode made possible by Restaurant Technologies, Inc. RTI's Total Oil Management automates your entire cooking oil process. With Total Oil Management, you get dependable fresh bulk cooking oil delivery, filtration plus oil usage monitoring and reporting, easy oil disposal, use cooking oil pickup and recycling, and say goodbye to messy, dangerous restaurant rendering tanks. Yuck. RTI's end-to-end cooking oil system helps you manage your used cooking oil disposal, storage, collection, and recycling conveniently, safely, and cleanly with no upfront cost. Restaurant Technologies, Inc. is always on, so you don't have to be. To learn more, head to RTI-Inc.com and let them know Restaurant Unstoppable Podcast sent you their way. This podcast was made possible by Restaurant Systems Pro, and we need to let you know that every second and fourth Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, CEO of Restaurant Systems Pro, Fred Langley, will be going live, where he'll cover what you need to know about running a profitable restaurant from soup to nuts. This live event will reveal the steps to manage the service and financial goals for your restaurant's productivity. To learn more, head to go.restaurantsystemspro.net/restaurantunstoppable. With excitement, allow me to introduce to you today's guest, owner and operator of Mangia Bene, my man, Jeff Good. Are you feeling unstoppable today?
I'm feeling unstoppable being called your man. Yeah. I've elevated quickly. I like this.
Hey, anybody who's willing to sit down with me for an hour and a half to 2 hours to share their story and their knowledge is instantly my man or a woman.
That's my honor.
And I cannot wait to dive into who you are. We should actually give a nod to our man.
Yeah, Robert St. John, yeah,
who introduced me to you, and he has been so generous with his network, just supporting this mission. He's a fan of the show, and he's trying to help me connect with those people that have a story to tell and who are just doing good stuff, and you're one of those people.
Yeah. He's an authentic powerhouse out of Hattiesburg, Mississippi, doing goodness for the whole world. He's
past guest on the show, too. I should probably figure out what that episode number is so I can reference people back to it, but we're here to talk about your story, and I cannot wait to get into it. So before we do, just share that success quote or mantra for me. What do you got?
Well, a good mantra for me on a daily basis is I ask God to help me to do the right thing. It's really, really important for me at my age and through the experience and the journey that I've been on that I'm really need to be mindful that I continue to try to do the right thing at every moment. And I think a lot like Disney with Keep the Park Clean as being, you know, their former, it could still be their corporate motto, that kind of keeps me centered.
What does that mean to you? Like, how do you distill that for somebody who maybe isn't religious? What does that mean?
Well, I have invoked God at the beginning of it to help me center, but actually it's a quite secular task. So when I say do the right thing, I'm trying to make sure that when I have an interaction with a employee, a customer, a vendor, a family member, somebody in community, myself, that I need to be careful to do the right thing. It is really easy to do something that is wrong, either on purpose, because you're trying to manipulate or steer an outcome to your benefit, and that might not be the best thing for all, or out of ignorance. You end up doing something because you didn't take a few moments, you didn't ask an opinion, you didn't ask for some advice. So when I say do the right thing, it's really just about really kind of taking a beat and making sure that you're if you're making especially important decisions, that you are calibrated. And even in the moment of a guest complaining about their dish, and you know that this guest is just a royal pain, and how you respond, either verbally or just with facial cues or body language, that's a moment where you can choose to do the right thing. For me, I think, you know, my choice, I hope, would be to do that with kindness, to do that with generosity, and to kind of, you know, bite my tongue for what I might want to say.
Yeah.
Because that's going to be a better outcome, I think, for all humanity. You know, right. the less nonsense that we put out there, probably the better.
I think this quote's coming at a good time as somebody who the verdict's still out for me in terms of I think I'm a spiritual person. I believe in something that is definitely out there that is beyond us, that had an influence in creating us. But I am definitely very curious about this thought of just consciousness, mm-hmm. and whether it be prayer or meditation, mm-hmm. or you fill in the blank, what your beliefs are. I think it's all the same thing at the end of the day. And it's so important just to be in the present, in the now, conscious, aware of how you're affecting other people. And I think the way what you share with us is just spot on.
Well, I appreciate that. And let's just, you know, let me jump right in. I mean, the audience for this is restaurateurs, so everyone's going to understand this immediately. Ours is not a business of quiet solitude and contemplative moments. And, you know, it's the shit hitting the fan. Every day, every moment, it is a nonstop parade of anxiety and things coming at you. And that's why I think it's really easy to lose yourself in
100%.
This business. And we see this happen with so many folks.
Yeah.
We see alcoholism, we see philandering, we see bad money management, we see ego, we see desperation, and folks, you know, get into the industry wanting to do something that's amazing, and they end up just totally destroying their lives.
And you tap onto that fear, anxiety, just general worry of what did I do? Yeah. How did I start? And like the book I'm listening to right now is The Power of Now.
Okay.
And it's just fascinating. This idea is that there is no past, there is no future, there is only now.
Yeah.
And just in that moment, separating your mind from reality and who you are, and knowing that those two things aren't the same, and you are not your emotions. This is a really powerful school.
This is really Buddha. This is very Zen.
And it's just once you really start to like meditate and just like or just pray or whatever your word is, it's just powerful. And that's where my mind went. So thank you for.
Well, I tell you what, you're on a great journey, and to be as young as you are to be taking that journey. So
starting to get some grays in the beard.
I'm gonna, you know, I'm an alcoholic. So halfway through my life, but you know, in the first couple of years of the journey in the restaurant business, I stopped drinking, and I learned how to drink in college, learned how to drink poorly, and that carried forward through my early my first job and my marriage into my choice to get into this business. And we can talk a little about that.
Yeah, that's actually a great segue.
That when you asked a question that's really kind of central to recovery, a lot of people come to the recovery movement, to what we call the rooms, the AA rooms, or to look at the program, the 12 steps. And they're really struggling because we're all broken people and we come from different backgrounds. And the idea of God and the idea of religion is really can almost be offensive. And the idea about recovery is just like there's no right as to what you believe. The idea is just not to rely on yourself. The idea is to get out of the idea of ego and selfness and learn how to share.
Yes.
And that gets back to this it's kind of where I am at 60 years old, this idea that I really want to be available for others, but I also want others to be available for me, and I'm not used to asking other people for help.
Yeah.
So it's just a big choice, you know, big change.
Yeah. This is awesome stuff, man. Okay, I can't wait to get into your story. So bring us to where it makes sense. I mean, I saw, you know, you once college, you were working for National Register. NCR. What does that stand for?
National Cash Register. Thank the old you. NCR Corporation.
Yes. And then in restaurants.
Yeah. Yeah. So can I go backward just a couple steps to go forward?
Please.
So my father was a college administrator, dean of students, vice president of student affairs, that kind of thing, small private liberal arts schools. Born in Mount Vernon, Iowa. Don't have much memory because we moved right after kindergarten. We moved to Salt Lake City, Utah.
Okay.
Saw a sticker on your carrying bag.
Yeah, I've been there.
So I was raised in Salt Lake from first grade through 11th grade. And so that was my formative years. And that really, really, as I, again, get older, reflecting back on things, a couple things happened there. Number one, I was not LDS. I was not Mormon. We were Methodist. We grew up in a city that was about 90% the same religion. And by the time I got into junior high and high school, and we all know how that is socially and how difficult it is, it was really difficult to be an odd man out. And there was a lot of soft prejudice and a lot of difficulties that came from that. Hand in hand with that, I started working when I was 13 years old. I was a janitor in a printing shop. Every day after school, I took a bus down to 9th East to Printers, Inc., and I cleaned 12 toilets, 8 urinals, and 3 shop floors. And I did that for about 2.5 hours. My hands broke out from all the chemicals. I mean, I'm 13 years old, 14 years old, and, you know, I'm a janitor. And if you really think about what that does in middle school and kind of a lot of the stuff that would happen, it really it was hard.
Not bad.
Dad comes home during my junior year and says, hey, we're going to move. I'm going to take a new job. I'm interviewing a couple places. He ended up taking a job in Jackson, Mississippi.
Okay.
At Millsaps College, small private liberal arts here. And so the summer between my junior and senior year, I moved to Salt Lake City, Utah with my parents. And it was as big a culture shock as one can imagine. I come from a community where everyone is white and blonde and pretty much homogenous. I come to a community, go to public high school, 65% African American, 35% Caucasian. I come to the Deep South from, again, a very different community of being Salt Lake, but the Mountain West. So, and I'm a kid. You know, I'm 17 going on 18, and really, really difficult to be able to assimilate. And worked as a cashier at a restaurant, minimum wage, and just grinding it out to try to be able to get enough money to buy a new battery for the used car I had that wasn't working. That whole way of how a lot of us in our industry, it's our first job, or second chance, but that entry level into making some form of money. So I'm doing that, and I'm at 3 weeks into my senior year. I'm chewing on a pen in a class. The pen explodes in my mouth. The teacher sees that I'm making some weird face. She asks me if there's a problem. I stick my tongue out. It's covered in ink, apparently. She sends me to the bathroom. It's like a John Hughes movie. The class explodes. I'm a complete freak. That afternoon, a guy in the classroom came up to me at lunch and said, hey, I think you probably need somebody to help you find your way around here. I'm Dan Blumenthal. And Dan became my best friend and eventually became my business partner.
Okay.
And that year in high school, he befriended me. He also took me to my first keg party and some other stuff. So I kind of glided through high school, getting into college. My dad, the dean of students at Millsaps, I get 80% off tuition. It's a very, very Tony school, country club school, select. So now I'm in an environment where kids have really nice cars. Their families take vacations. They have vacation homes. They go skiing. And I am still working as a cashier. I pledge a fraternity, and I fail out my freshman year. I don't go to class. I totally am screwed up. So the dean of students calls me to his office and says, "Hey, you need to take we're kicking you out of school. You need to go home to the dean of students' house." So I move back home with mom and dad, and that is the time I realized something had to change. And I got an opportunity to get a job waiting tables.
Okay. How old are you at this point?
I am 19? Now 19. 19, okay. Exactly. 19 going on 20.
Got it.
So that summer, I get a job waiting tables.
19. That's right. It's not. It's 18 going to 19. And all of a sudden, I'm making more money per hour than I've ever made.
Right.
And I'm damn good at it. And I really lean into that job, and I come back after a semester off to school, and I get serious about school. I end up becoming, I find the school of business. It's my people, my language. I find a great couple of great professors that believe in me. I become a straight-A student, really finished strong, met my wife, and, you know, nobody would have anything to do with me. And she saw the diamond in the rough and really loved me through it. She was a classics major, became a Latin teacher. And, you know, we graduated and started our lives together.
What changed in you to go from fail, dropout, you know, partier, crazy, no self-control to straight A student?
Well, and the screwing up ain't over yet. But consequence. So the consequence was you just got kicked out of college. You know, where's your life going?
You said something else that kind of resonated with me. I don't know if you picked up on it or if it just kind of like, but you said that people saw something in you and they believed in you.
Yeah, I think my parents did, and then Debbie did, my wife. She saw something where others did not.
Were there
she did.
Business professors that saw?
Absolutely, yeah.
What was your first focus when you first went?
Crazy enough, my freshman year, I had enrolled pre-med, and I took zoology, the weed-out class, and... Eric, why don't you ask me if I ever took a science class in high school?
Did you ever?
The answer would be I took physics. I took physics for 101. So what the hell was I doing in there?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I completely did not. I think that's a great example of how rudderless I was.
Did something change in you when you, I mean, you think of becoming, the path, if you're a bartender or server,
right.
And that is sales.
Yeah.
100% all day long, you're a salesperson. Yep. You're selling the food, you're selling the restaurant, you're selling yourself, you are being likable, it's sales. It sounds like you kind of started to become a little bit more self-aware in terms of what your strengths were. And then were you encouraged to go into business? Like, why business? So like, what does somebody see that you had a strength or a mind for it?
I think I literally found a class, and all of a sudden the language started to make sense. It just clicked. And it was something that, again, since I was, as you said, a salesman, you know, waiting tables and the like, I think that genre made a lot more sense than political science or history or English or I was at a liberal arts school, so it was small. So the pathways were somewhat limited. You couldn't take, aeronautics or something like that.
Right. So this is what, the late 90s?
So yeah, this would be, you flatter me, sir. Graduated in 86, got a job with NCR Corporation. Debbie and I started our lives here, and I sold computers. So, and this, you know, Eric, I actually can answer your question specifically. The thing that started and the thing that I realized I had was I had a lot of grit and tenacity to keep going. Mm. So I can work, and I can outwork many, and I just have to be, you know, like all of us, I have to be motivated. But I found that motivation. I found that motivation with school. I had to finish school. I found that motivation with starting this career with the National Cash Register Company. So I got recruited through college, got a job offer to sell large computer systems, traveled the Mississippi Delta and up to Tennessee and Arkansas, going to factories in small towns, knocking on doors, trying to talk to the managing director or the CEO if it was family owned, and ask him about, you know, what kind of computer do you have, and do you have a computer system, what kind of computer you run the shop floor with, and just have that whole conversation. Time after time after time being told we're not interested, having the door closed on you, learning that rejection over and over again, which I was kind of familiar with in some ways, but I had a goal now. And I was good at it, and I was able to make a couple really good sales years, made some good money, things were prosperous. This is the mid-80s into the 90s. We were selling what would be called an old mini computer, which to people your age would think that's a mainframe with the thing you see on TV with the false floors and everything. Exactly. PCs came along.
Yeah.
My company was not well poised for that. The products that we had really quickly atrophied. And by 1992, AT&T purchased NCR. 93, they made the announcement that they were going to close the division I worked for, and they're going to close the Jackson Field office.
Oh, man.
Because we had an office here. It was a small, but we had an office. So I was told I had an option to think about moving to Dayton, Ohio, which I'd already spent a year there out of college. They had a year-long training program that was 6 weeks up, 3 weeks back kind of thing. So I've been to Dayton. Nothing wrong with Dayton.
Hey, Dayton's on the come up right now.
It is. It's one of those things. It's now, you know, hell, if I would have
waited 20, 30 years.
But But at that point in time, 33 years ago, the couple buddies I had around the nation that I knew that took the promotion, it ended up in one of those sad corporate stories that 6 months after moving up there, they had one of those mass layoffs. So I did the right thing by not moving, because God knows I probably would have been first on the list. But I tried to find a job. And this, I'm now moving into the restaurant. So I tried to find a job selling technology, selling executive level technology sales. I didn't want to sell phone systems or phone service. I wanted to sell systems. And I had a hard time in Jackson, Mississippi, finding something. And I had a bead on a job that I went after for about 3 months, and I was told I wasn't going to get it. The night I was told I wasn't get it, the day I was told I wasn't going to get it, I got on the phone, I called that best friend from high school. We'd stayed in touch. He was in San Francisco. He went to University of California, Santa Cruz, became an economics major, graduated, moved to San Francisco, worked for a law firm as a paralegal for a year while he studied for the LSAT, came home at Christmas that year, told his parents, I hate law. I want to be a chef. Went back, went to California Culinary Academy there on Polk Street, working in restaurants. So I called Dan. I say, Dan, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm going to lose my job. I haven't told you what's going on over here. Dev and I are worried, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, well, I'm not very happy where I am. I'm the fourth restaurant since graduating culinary school. I came here to work under the chef. It's a two-man kitchen. They got me waiting tables and managing the wine list, which is great because I'm drinking great wine, but I'm not in the kitchen. Phone gets quiet. We say, maybe we should go into business together. Maybe we should open a restaurant.
So Dan's face is all over the place downstairs. This is the gentleman. Okay, I'm starting to connect.
That is actually his grandfather. Oh. He's all over the place.
Okay,
yeah, that's his grandfather. There was a baker in Trenton, New Jersey. Broad Street is named after the street that the Blumenthal Bakery was located in Broad Street in Trenton, New Jersey.
It's all coming together. So he wasn't working. Was he working in restaurants this whole time while going through school?
No. He came home at summertime from college, and I actually taught him how to wait tables. I got him a job two summers in a row where I was working. So I was the teacher. He was the student. But when he went to culinary school, then coming out of that, he worked in four different restaurants.
So between the two of you, how much restaurant experience do you say?
Not much. So he had. He had probably 3 years jumping between, 3 to 4 years jumping between four places, and I'd waited tables in college. I'd never managed anybody. I'd checked out some people sidework-wise.
Right. So look, what's going through my mind right now, up to this, the story that you shared with us, that you worked in the restaurants, but you never had a burning dream, a desire to open a restaurant one day. Where did this
nor the competence.
Where did this come from? Was it just because he was saying he wanted to become a chef?
So no. We got to remember, I'm calling and saying, I'm going to lose my job. I don't know what I'm going to do. And his response is, I'm not happy doing what I'm doing. I don't know if San Francisco is going to be the place for me. I can't even get in the kitchen.
Yeah, he wants to be a chef.
And he's the idea is, I want to cook. I want to be a chef.
So was he the one that really was pushing for this?
So when we kind of came up together with the idea of a business, and because he was a tactician, he's the skilled one. He's a chef.
Yeah.
I'm a salesman, right? And so we knew each other well. We knew each other's skills, and so we knew that we believed in each other. So here's the process. So we say, let's open a restaurant. So we start talking about originally a pastry shop, coffee place. Realize that's not going to be big enough to feed the two of us. And then he says, hey, I've worked for quite some time at a place here, Italian trattoria style. I think this is the coming thing again. This is 1993. This is really the big thing. Wolfgang Puck was on his ascension. Todd English and on the East Coast. Mario Batali was coming later on. So that whole idea about this genre was starting to build. And we're right here in the heartland, in the Deep South. We Olive Garden, and
right.
So he says, why don't we think about doing something like that? And so we come up with this idea for Bravo, our first restaurant. We do a 60-page business plan. It's pretty impressive. We're both business majors. We know how to write. His younger brother, David, was here in Jackson, was working in the industry and said, I'd like to be a part of this. He had a bar skill. He was a bar manager at a restaurant here. So Dan had the food. I was going to do the service and the business. Dave would do the bar. We put this business plan together. I met with a buddy of mine from college that was a banker. Sat down at lunch, told them all about it, said, look at this restaurant. You can imagine every one of the folks, all of you have done this. You're talking to the banker with your dream. I got this great idea. I'm going to open this restaurant. I'm going to make the best ham and cheese sandwich ever. It's going to be better than anyone else's.
How many no's did you get?
So he looks at me and goes, I say, we're going to need $500,000 to fund this. How do I borrow $500,000? And he goes, we can loan you $500,000 tomorrow if you have $500,000 in the bank. If you have money, you can borrow money. And of course, he knew me well, and he says, you don't have any money. And I'm like, no, I don't have any money. How about your partner? No, nothing like that. No family? No, that's not going to happen. So the no was, that was, most people, you know, when you talk to the bank, that's it, right? That's the hard stop, Eric. That's it. No. Grit, resilience. So back up a couple of things, and this is maybe some of my life story. My wife and I, first getting married, not much money. We started volunteering for some of the arts organizations by handing out programs at the auditorium or helping to do different volunteer things. We kind of settled on Ballet Mississippi, which is our professional dance company here, and we met some other young people that were doing the same thing. We all became good friends. We started to support them, did some after-performance parties, created this young person support group. I was seen, and I was asked to serve on the board. So I'm 26 years old, and I've been asked to serve on a major arts board in a capital city. And, you know, the people that serve on arts boards are traditionally rich people,
right,
and ladies with blue hair.
Yep.
So
you got this network.
I have this network. Yeah. So I fall back and I say, hey, I talked to a couple of oil men, real estate guys, oil real estate. And I say, hey, I hear you guys talking all the time about how you put these deals together. How do you raise money for like an oil well? And they go, well, we put together a limited partnership. We sell shares of stock. We're the general partner. We own the process and we keep control of it. And everyone, you know, participates to their, talk to a lawyer, talk to an accountant, 250-page business plan. We're going to, offering document, we're going to sell units, and a limited partnership. I'm this old. We didn't have a limited liability company, an LLC, at that point in Mississippi. It wasn't law. So limited partnership's the same thing. It's just different name. And I went to selling. So I prospected, meaning to talk to face-to-face or on the phone, 750 people.
Holy cow, man.
And I'm not
sure. This is where that sales background comes
and,
in.
And resiliency and taking no and not stopping.
How bad do you want it?
And I found quickly that people that were interested, I mean, people weren't interested, it was a quick no. People that were interested, you carry it along, and they want to say, well, tell me about your chef. You must have this great Italian chef. And where is he? And I'm like, well, okay.
He's my friend from high school.
He's Jewish, not Italian. And I think he's pretty good. I've eaten his food a couple of times. But he's in San Francisco. Is he coming home? He's going to come home when this becomes more real. Because, and I understand where Dan was. He's like, I'm not going to come home hoping something happens. I'm here, rent-controlled apartment. I'm doing okay. So I found out that people wanted to taste the food. So Dan and David talked a little bit over the phone, Dan's younger brother. David could cook, thank God. And so we came up with this plan for dinner parties. So I started inviting people to my little two-bedroom house in the Bellhaven community here. So every Tuesday or Thursday night of every week, I'd have 8 to 10 people in. My neighbors thought I started selling Amway.
This is actually a great time to take a first break to thank our sponsors, and we'll get into how you pulled it off. This episode made possible by Owner.com. Owner.com is the quickest and easiest way for your customers to order directly from you without the expensive 30% commission fees. With Owner.com, you'll save thousands every month when customers order through your website and branded app instead of third-party delivery apps, and reward your customers with a built-in loyalty program that turns them into regulars who order again and again. Owner.com also helps you rank higher on Google with world-class search engine optimization built specifically for restaurants with an AI-powered website. We cannot forget lists. Build a huge list of people who live near your restaurant fast and market to that list on autopilot with text and email sent at the perfect time to help you grow sales and stay top of mind. Owner.com gives you everything you need to grow and market your restaurant online with no contracts or hidden fees. Visit Owner.com/unstoppable right now to book your free demo and see why thousands of restaurant owners trust Owner.com to power their restaurants online. This episode is brought to you by Mies. Running the back of house brings a whole suite of challenges, like distributing intellectual property from your chef's brain to your back of house team across all of your locations. Once that information gets distributed, you still have to train your back of house to ensure the recipes are being executed accurately and consistently. Once everybody is trained, you still have to nail down profit calculations, which can be a nightmare when your team doesn't fully understand theoretical food costs, factoring in yields, and unit conversions. Then, once all this is done, you still have to push the information across all of your locations in real time, factoring in the prices that are constantly changing. Are you kidding me? That's where Mies comes in. With Mies, you can standardize your culinary intellectual property and stay in sync as a team. You can train your team quickly and maintain dish consistency by turning your recipes into interactive training material, and you can get laser accurate food costs because Mies allows you to calculate the yields of your ingredients with prep loss included. Create a free account by visiting getmeez.com/unstoppable. That's getmeez.com/unstoppable. And as a listener of Restaurant Unstoppable, you can get 25 recipes uploaded to your Mies account for free. Sign up today and learn more at getmeez.com/unstoppable. We're back, and you were just getting into the gold, my friend.
Yeah.
And up to this point, I love your approach of just the resilience, not taking no for an answer, taking the no's away, finding out why people are saying no, and then kicking that frontal lobe into hyper gear and just trying to solve the problems. No, why? Okay, yeah. There's a yes somewhere. How do I find the yes? And just trying to everything you've done up to this point, I love it, man.
Okay.
So you start with just, you know, you're selling shares essentially to mm-hmm. your business. You're going to crowdsource essentially mm-hmm. the business. You're going to go to your network of people that you've influenced over time, and you're going to crowdsource this money. And you start with dinner parties, or what people I think would call today pop-ups. But this yep. was at your house.
Yep.
So this is more like a dinner party, actually, because if it's at your house, then this is a great way to start. Why is this a great way to start?
Well, it's the only way to start. So, you know, when you mentioned it, the one thing that is incorrect in what you said is I'm going to my sphere of influence. I had no sphere of influence.
These are your art friends, right?
So it started with that small group, you know, and yes, I had some, but very quickly I filtered through.
There were no yeses in that group?
There's a couple. Okay. And they in turn, I'd say, it was like an insurance salesman, you know, yeah. If you're not interested, do you know somebody who is? So, you know, one person would introduce to another person. You meet a doctor would bring in somebody else from his practice. Then they bring in a brother, you know, that kind of thing. But it was really hand-to-hand combat. But I believed in it deeply. That's why I stayed motivated. I you know, gets back to that thing about when I got serious about college. This is important. I got to do this. And I believed in it. And I believed in the product. I believed we could do it. So I fed 250 people in my house, 10 people at a time. And we did it through a buffet standpoint. We didn't do a seated dinner. They'd come in. We'd have a spread on the dining room table, wine. We were big into California wine. We were trying to explain that, you know, this is, again, back in 1993 in Jackson, Mississippi, wine was very mystical. So the idea was there's a lot of great things that you can have that you may not understand the label that's tasty and yada, yada. And we would then sit everybody on the sofa, a couple chairs in the living room, and present the plan, hand them the business plan. So 750 people prospected, 250 people fed. We got 44 people to invest $10,000 apiece.
Wow.
So, and that was back in 93. Dan, David, and I both put in $3,333.33. I put in 34 cents, became the president, and we started construction. We did a lot of it ourselves. We had a contractor. We had a great shopping center here, great restaurant that had opened and closed a couple times in the facility we're already in.
Did that scare you?
Sure, but hell, we were going to do it. It's like any restaurateur. Right. Oh yeah, don't worry about that.
They're not us.
We had already been through that 1,000 times yeah. when talking to. When somebody said yes, the next thing is I had to take the documents to them and walk through that. And we had the full thing. We had an investor questionnaire. They had to be a suitable investor. They had to have a certain amount of wealth in order to invest with us. We didn't want to take anybody who was under that because we didn't want to take granny's money.
Right.
So we did it all right. So when you're sitting on somebody else's dining room table or office talking about your business, that's when they start asking all the questions. Well, what the hell makes you think you're going to do better? I mean, before you're always holding the pen, right? They got the checkbook. Well, you know, I remember one guy, he pulls out a newspaper, the weekly business newspaper. He opens up to the back page, and he holds it like this to me, and he says, "You see this?"
And I'm like, yeah, that says tax liens. He says, don't show up on this list. And I'm like, yes, sir. So the process was, our business plan was very detailed. I had a buddy that worked, he had a job for a short period of time at Wall Street. And he told me, we had a more detailed plan than most prospectuses he saw that were, you know, shopped around as private placements. We knew our business down to the knife, fork, and spoon. We budgeted it to what it was. Did it turn out to be exactly that? Oh, hell no. All of these things are projected. But yeah, we were very realistic. And we gave away so much to our investors. And this is something I talk to a lot of people, because crowdsourcing is all the, you know, Kickstarter. Yeah. Everything, everything, well, I'm going to get my. So in a nutshell, Eric, very quickly. $10,000 share. We said, the three of us will make $30,000 a year, plus health care. That's it.
That's good money in 93.
It was good. It was, but we were the only managers. We were 8 o'clock until 2.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what that did to my lifestyle. So my life. But that was it. So it was going to be a $90,000 management expense, and then all hourly employees. We're going to give 100% of all proceeds that came through. Any distributable cash would go to the investors until they received their $10,000 back. We would pay an 8% interest rate on top of that for time value money. And we would pay everyone their tax burden at the end of the year. So if the business made $100,000 and if an investor had a $5,000, you know, tax bill, a $5,000 income, remanded on their K-1, and their taxes are 36%, we assume that, we would give them 36% of 5,000, so roughly what? A couple thousand dollars.
Wow.
So we gave them their tax liability every year until they got paid back. So the bottom line is, when we said paid back, it was $14,300 before you received the real $10,000 back in your pocket. And at that point, we took 45% of the business, and the investors kept 55% of the business for the life of the business.
This was all part of the original plan.
And that is how we got 44 people to invest in the chef in San Francisco that didn't come home. By the way, David, the third partner, 1 month into our work, his restaurant closed under great... It was an outstanding restaurant, the best restaurateur in town, and he failed. And so now he was out of work, and we're talking about opening a restaurant because we know what we're doing. So if you really see what it took.
Yeah.
And that's okay, because it was fair. It was the cost of capital at that time. And it all worked out okay.
You're doing a few things that I think is just good beyond, you know, everything you shared with us was great. But you've cash allocated owner's pay.
Yes.
Right. And I think a lot of people don't do that. You said, we're going to pay ourselves $90,000. That is, we are on the payroll, mm-hmm. right? And you put yourself on the payroll. You took your money. Any profit beyond that went towards paying off debt, i.e. the money that was invested in you. And then you said beyond that, it was 8% interest.
8% interest.
On
capital account. So if it was $10,000, after we paid back whatever principal, there'd be $8,000. It's like paying a loan back.
Got it.
The idea was that if we never made money, we'd still be racking up an interest payment. It was another piece of candy in the offering.
Is there anything beyond that you said? You dropped a lot.
It was 8% plus the tax liability.
Plus the tax liability. Yeah. And 50% of the business.
And 50%.
So your investors own 50% of the
55.
Business. 55% mm-hmm. of the business. You and your two partners owned 45%.
Right, 15 each.
Knowing what you know now, would you do that again, or is that what you had to do in order to get started?
That's what I had to do. And so I can just quickly fast forward to 1998. So we opened in 1994 there. In 1998, December, we opened Broad Street. We had a $1.2 million budget. I had one meeting, which was a presentation at an auditorium facility in a hotel downtown. Had 250 people show up. We went to Memphis to a bakery up there to get croissant, arugula, brioche, things like that, to lay it out, do sandwiches and salads to show people. You know, it was, again, a buffet. Made one PowerPoint presentation, and in 20 days sold 80 $15,000 shares. And we did not give away that structure. We did a 65-35 split, but we also set it up, being very frank, that we take a 7% management fee off the top-line revenue. So every 7 cents on every dollar comes to the operator.
plus we get 35% of profit.
So you're taking profit.
I'm taking revenue. Think of, I want to say it again.
Income.
When you buy that cup of coffee, you buy 3 cups of coffee for $10, I get 70 cents.
Got it.
So you really think about that as that's a very large amount of revenue, and that was something we were able to work out because we had a track record.
Right. So the first time you what you're basically paying for is the track record.
You're paying for the right to go into the business.
Everything that comes after that.
Because what did the bank say?
No. Right. So you got to give in the beginning before you can expect to get. You have to, especially if you're high risk. Another thing that taking that 7% off the top, that is that's profit first mentality.
That is
right
profit
there.
First.
Are you familiar with that book?
I know, but I understand what you're saying. You know what? Educate me.
I mean, it sounds like, so it's just the idea that you got to take. So there's owner's pay.
Okay.
But beyond that, 10%, they say 10% of every dollar you make. You know, 10 cents on every dollar goes mm-hmm. to a separate profit account that is usually a high yield savings account that you only spend that money unless you're investing in an asset or you're paying off debt. But that idea, like you open a business to make profit. So you have to build it into a system around it.
Absolutely.
And then it forces you to get lean and it forces you to not overextend yourself. So this second approach you took, was that for your next restaurant?
That was for Broad Street.
Broad
Street. That's how we did
this. What year was that?
That was 1998.
So 5 years after your first restaurant.
So we had paid off the investors in 3 years and 8 months.
That was my question. Did you say that already and I missed it?
I just didn't tell you how long it took. I told you how much they got.
3 years.
Three years, 8 months.
So after you paid them off, did they still own equity?
So they still own 55% for the balance of the business. That's what I'm trying to say.
So, okay.
You follow me?
Yes, I do. I am kind of curious.
But all the other payments go away. So it's just a total 45-55 split. Plus we get our salary, and we gave ourselves salary raises.
I'm guessing some of your investors were on the older side.
Many have passed away.
That's my question.
And so this is a private placement. There is no stock exchange for this. Usually they'll just, they will contact me ahead of time, or if it's gone to a state, the attorney will, or family member will contact me and say, hey, we'd like to transfer this to so-and-so. I said, just give me the social security number. We move it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. I was curious if that was,
and I manage all that myself.
Wow.
Yeah.
So I was, my curiosity was after they had passed, does it go back to the business or does it get passed down?
No. Wow, and I'm sure you could write a deal like that. That's not the way our agreement was written.
Well, I mean, To get, you got to give.
Yeah.
And that's one of the biggest lessons I've learned. You can't expect to get anything until you've given first.
And over the years, just for hope, for those listening, or kind of if we're watching this and if there's somebody who's dying to be an entrepreneur and is buying into all this and all of a sudden saying, oh my God, I can't do that. Let's fast forward 30 years and let me say that, you know, I've got 3 restaurants. We're running just under $12 million in revenue. I have a lot of corporate overhead built into our businesses. I have an office that with a staff, small staff. I have my own, you know, pay. I've got a couple right-hand, left-hand folks, operations and culinary that work side by side with me. There's, you know, the flexibility of owning and operating, being the person who makes the decisions, allows you to make, it doesn't always have to be as thin as it was the first year we're open at Bravo, where it was all about just get the investors paid back. Once you start building the business out and you start getting a little bit of profit here and some fat and you could kind of figure out how to do. Because I'm here with you right now. We have a huge night going on at Sal and Mickey's right now. I'm not there.
Thank you so much for...
Well, my pleasure. Yeah. My pleasure. Because I don't have to be there.
Right.
Would some outcomes be better if I was there? Probably. But you know what? If I was to always lament, if only I was in the Bravo dining room right now carrying a creme brulee to table 64 and saying, happy anniversary for being here. Oh, Jeff Good just brought us our dessert. How fantastic. I will have no life.
Right.
So I have to be able to segregate myself. And you do that by being able to pay others.
Right. And you have to create those layers between you and the work or else you'll burn out. I mean, you can't have a business that depends on you. So good on you for being willing and able to.
Because I did for a long time.
Yeah. So did you say $30 million in revenue?
No. Where are you getting it? No, 30 years later.
Oh, Jesus.
30 years later, just under 12. That $11.5
million. Wow. That's still.
So that's the 3 restaurants and our catering.
Got it.
For Jackson, Mississippi, all in Jackson, Mississippi, and as a sense of place, some of your viewers may say, Jackson, this sounds familiar, the water crisis. We're the capital city.
I was going to get into that eventually.
We're the capital city that had the water system fail a number of times. And the federal government, first of all, the state took it over and then turned it over to the federal government. And we're very thankful very thankful that the federal government came in and rescued us.
Let's bookmark this because I want to come back to it. I think it's something when we get to like present where you are and the influence you have. So I want to kind of pull back some layers. So go on, you're giving amazing detail, by the way. I don't even have to ask you questions. You're just dumping it out, which is awesome. Thank you so much. But I want to talk about struggles. You talked about the struggle of just finding the money, right? Yeah. And now you got creative to find it and what you were willing to offer, what you're willing to give to get it. What were your biggest struggles after getting the money and getting open? Three dudes, not a lot of experience. Take me to like the struggle.
All right. So first off, we were doing a product that had not been seen before in this market. So Dan had great skill. And he brought a series of products that are very common now, but focaccia bread, bruschetta, polenta, wood-fired pizzas. Mm. We have a wood-fired oven in the center. It's an open kitchen. We did a food bar, pizza oven, sandwich units around in the dining room. And the old restaurant that we were in was very much a American Continental restaurant. Low ceilings, walls, quiet service, bow ties and suits. So this is, we brought the restaurant, all one room, no walls, no smoking.
So
we were way ahead of the curve. And so the food, people would say, this doesn't taste like Mario's. In place in South Jackson. This doesn't taste like their Big
City. This isn't authentic.
And it was different. I love Mario's. Yeah. I used to love it. I miss it so much. Their creamy sauce Big City was so good. But it was nothing like what we did.
Yeah.
So the challenge of knowing... So I was customer, Dan's in the kitchen, and I come back and say, you know, nobody likes this. We got to change this. You know, and he goes, stay the course. Trust me. I know what I'm doing. 6 months into the business, it was like a light switch turned. All of a sudden, we became the standard. People started saying, we can't get this kind of food anywhere. This is, you know, we wish that such and such a restaurant, you know, where we live, in our neighborhood, would do something like this. So I think the biggest struggle was believing. You know, we believed in ourselves, but then when it came time to do it, do you really believe in yourself?
Yeah, how do you find that balance between... being willing to pivot and adapt to, some people say, you know, give the market what they want and just adapt to what they want. Other people say, you know, you have to cook for what lights you up, what you're passionate about, because you won't have the endurance to show up unless you're passionate.
Well, I've seen some restaurants that have closed because they were immovable in that issue. And particularly if they were chef creative driven and there was a real, you know, we need to train our customer and, you know, our customers should know better. And I do believe we should train our customers. We should love them through understanding what we're doing. But we also need to realize we're merchants. This is our stock and trade today. This is what we have to sell. Would you like to buy?
Yeah.
And people will, you know, nobody goes in a restaurant to shop. They buy. But they may never come back.
Right.
So, you know, I think it's important that restaurateurs, we need to see that. So, We've, over time, that restaurant, the original venue was very small, and it was very, very 3-3-3 kind of a thing.
What do you mean by very small? You mean
very small choice. You know,
like how many choices?
I think we had, you know, you might have four appetizers, three salads, you know, a half dozen pizzas, you know, 10-inch pizzas, and maybe three pastas, no entrees.
This is kind of ahead of the time.
Right, yeah, but well, now we're much bigger. We've got full on. You know, our customers told us we'd love to have pieces of fish. We'd love to have a steak. We'd love to have this. So we morph that out. We don't have a pizza menu that's this big. So we still have about, you know.
You stay true to the style of food.
Bingo.
But you added different options in that vertical of style.
Absolutely.
What would you say Dan's style was? Was it Northern Italian?
Tuscan. That kind of mid Italian. Very, you know, simple ingredients. Three or four.
But I think also like what you're seeing today. If I'm opening a restaurant tomorrow, I'm doing one or two things. Like, in terms of like genre, like I'm staying in a lane and I'm being the best at it.
Yep.
And I think today we try to be so much to so many different people.
You can't
people.
Be everything to everyone or you'd be nothing for nobody.
Exactly. Yep. And I think beyond that, training, cost of goods, inventory, all these other things that just suck up cash. If you can just carve out a niche, and today I think it goes even beyond that because now you have to reverse engineer for SEO. how am I going to show up in the marketplace when somebody's looking for me? And if you can just own a market and do one thing and be known for that one thing, when someone is looking for that one thing, you're going to show up. Yep. Everything today, I think, is if you just put all of your energy into doing one thing, you can do other stuff. Create a whole nother brand for that other stuff. Have each thing you want to do is a different concept. And today you can do it with ghost kitchens all out of the same restaurant. You know what I'm saying? It's amazing what you can do. And then if something catches foothold, scale it.
I can't wait to see you open a few restaurants this way. I'm going to follow you, Eric.
Well, I mean, other people are doing it, you know, and I'm seeing and I'm paying.
That's fascinating.
And I'm listening.
So sense of place. I'm in a community here where we topped out in population at 200,000 in 1980. We have 145,000 right now. The suburbs have grown massively. So we are 500,000 MSA, but the city proper is only 145,000. We're an 85% African-American city. 25% of our population is below the poverty level. There's a lot of restaurants in this town, though. There's still a lot of creativity, and there's a lot of rethinking neighborhoods and having things happen. But there's not a lot of population, and there's not a lot of industry here. We have medical and education and government. So our ability to, when you start talking about doing something that is like you see in a bigger market or something that can pull from a lot of areas, it's a little different. So,
but
I don't disagree at all with what you're saying. I have found there's a certain amount of comfort that our market finds that they know if you come to one of our restaurants, there's a broad choice to choose from.
Yeah.
Everything is good. If it's not good, we get rid of it.
Right.
And there's value. We are generous in our portions. We're premium priced, generous in our portions, so you can take additional food home. And that's part of our goal.
So I'm happy you brought that up, this idea of like market matters for sure. Yep. I think what I shared before does better in heavy populated areas where there's a bunch of different people who are looking for different things. But to your point, in more rural areas, it's more difficult to own just an item.
And that's part of, again, being realistic. You know, we've learned a lot. You said, what was the hardest thing about opening? I immediately went to selling, getting people. The real hard part, and anyone who's in the restaurant business knows what I'm going to say next, it's the hours, dude.
Right.
So 8 in the morning till 2 in the morning, 6 days a week. We're open Tuesday through Sunday.
How many hours were you sleeping?
Not much, because the other thing is it was fun to hang out with the waiters and go drink and play darts.
I mean, I'll be honest. It's one of the things I love the most about the restaurant industry is we know how to have a good time.
Yeah. So, you know, you'd when I say 2 o'clock, you know, we really were done closing down by 12:30, but, you know, you'd hang around the bar, have a couple drinks and talk. I would have been
91?
Yeah, so born in 63, opened in 93, I was 30 years old.
30, yeah. Yeah. You're still in that have fun phase, sure.
And I'm drinking. I was never a day drinker unless it was vacation time. But every night, you know, when we would clear the wheel, check all the tables, you know, get desserts. You know, are we done with the? You know, start checking waiters out. It was scotch time. I drink 3 or 4 scotches every night. So, you know, you go home, you wake up with a headache. You know, you wash, rinse, repeat. And then on Mondays when we're closed, we would do inventory maintenance, you know, paperwork and the like. So, you know, 9 to 3, 9 to 4, unless we did a party that night. And then, so we might work the, you know, bring a private event in. But if we're not doing a private event, party was the word. It was time to go party.
Yeah.
And so my wife really didn't see me. You know, so a hard part about this was what I did to myself, but also the complete change. I was a computer salesman, traditional job, home on the weekends, home most nights, you know, unless I'm traveling. And now I'm never home. Her grandfather passes away. I can't go because I'm busy with work. I can't go. Could I have gone? Yeah.
So when I say inspire, empower, and transform the industry, I think it's stuff like this. And I think that the reason this culture that you're sharing with us is self-induced, it's self-made. I don't know if it's out of ego or fear of if I don't work hard, the person down the street is going to work harder than me. But it seems like you've been able to get away from that because you're sitting here with me.
With age. You've seen the bear.
Yeah.
I was in the walk-in cooler.
I think there's a period where, like, I think when you're first getting started, you have to get that flywheel spinning.
Yep.
You got to build the momentum.
You have to, or else you won't be there.
Right.
The reason Bravo, 30 years, April 7th. So we're here in the first week of April doing this. And one thing you may not have picked up is in, what is it, in 3 days, that'll be what, Saturday the 7th? Sunday the 7th? That's my 30th anniversary. That's the day we opened. Man. So
3 days.
3 days.
Thank you so much for carving out time.
My pleasure. My pleasure. So 30 years in Jackson, Mississippi. And if you ask an employee what's the right way to do it, I hope some of the new ones might do it, might not, but the majority of them would say, we do things the Bravo way. And I didn't coin that. That came out of...
I think I'm going to go there for dinner tonight. I probably can't get in with all the stuff you got going on.
Oh, no. Bravo will be probably perfect.
I want to ask people.
So there's a way of doing things, the Bravo way. And it's just meaning that we, you know, whatever that is, paying attention to detail, being kind to people, you know, doing the right thing. That DNA is there so I could sit here with you, but the flywheel had to be created. So you can't start this kind of a business and do it from a desk. You can't pick and choose when you're going to work on your early business. And I think this goes for any business. You got to be in it to get it going. But once you get it going, I think the problem for me, and this did come from working with two other men, having a weird relationship that I got in this weird, all in my head, you know, I can work harder than you two. And also, you guys don't have wives, but I have a wife over here, but she doesn't count. You know, I got to stay, it's about this.
Yeah.
And so I'm violating the relationship with my marriage. I'm having an affair with my business. My wife started calling Bravo, Bravette.
Well, that was my next question. We started going there, and there was like the next challenge for you. The first challenge was staying the course of the identity until people bought into what you were trying to do. The second challenge was finding the work-life balance. And, you know, like you said, 6 days a week from 8 a.m. to 2 a.m. What was the tipping point? Like, what was, or I should ask, what was the breaking point, and then how did things start to change?
Well, two things. So I wish I could say that the day I got a DUI is the day that I changed my whole work-life balance. That happened in June 26th of 1996.
So 2 years before opening your second restaurant.
1997.
1 year.
1997. So, yeah, that was 3 years into Bravo. And I'd started doing some community work, so to speak. We did a big fundraiser for the police department, the restaurants
did. Was this before or after the DUI?
This is before. So it's okay. This is the great story. This is it's going to be quick, but it's a fantastic story. So I tell it rarely, so it's a good one. A couple of restaurateurs and I put together the idea of supporting the police department by creating a taste event. We call it Take a Tasty Bite Out of Crime. And so we raised money to help with law enforcement. And this had never been done in this market before. We did it fantastic. We did it at Highland Village. We brought in two truckloads of sand. We created a Caribbean, you know, these sand dunes, and we had reggae bands, and 30 restaurants brought their wares, and we had corporate tables, and we had waiters waiting on the corporate tables, and it was a great event. Raised a lot of money. Three, 4 weeks after the event, the committee wanted to fet the two or three of us that were the leads, and so we all went out on Monday night, and we went to a local steakhouse, and after scotch, wine, and apparently the last drink I ever had was a frosty mug of beer from On the Border. Never been there in my life. I got arrested going home on a DUI, and that was the last time I took a drink. That consequence, my wife had said, you know, I'd had one in college, and she said, "You've got to stop this." So I stopped drinking, and went through a minor recovery, meaning I spent some time doing some AA work and doing some group work, and then I just got busy with work again, and I just threw myself into the work, and I never drank again, and still have not drank again. But I was absolutely hollow, and the work-life balance. This is going to freak you out. The work-life balance came when COVID hit.
Really?
I had a midlife crisis. Wow. On March the 18th, I wrote a letter to fire 180 people, closing three restaurants, Dan, my partner, was absolutely just, he became a turtle, just fell into himself. And
there
I was.
During the pandemic?
This is the pandemic. Yeah, this is the 2019, writing that letter. Then closing all the restaurants, not knowing what's going to happen, and then having to figure out a way to keep going. So here's the unstoppable moment.
Yeah.
We're 3 days in. I've canceled all my streaming services. I've watched this, what little stock portfolio I have, collapse. My wife is looking at me and saying, this is not what we signed up for, and not in a mean way, but she's scared as hell. But she's truthful.
Oh, yeah, it's terrifying.
It's not what we signed up for.
Right.
I've got three leases on my head, you know, and how are we going to get through this? We're not going to be able to reopen a restaurant because nobody knew. Get a call from a local grocery, and they say, "Hey, you got a bakery? You know, there's no bread. You know, you don't make toilet paper. Wish you did. You know, can you bake some bread for us?" I call a couple of the bakers, and I say, "Guys, can we meet, and can we try this together?" So we show up downstairs, and we're in masks, and we make a bake. And one bake becomes two, three guys become five guys become 10. As we get delivery, slicing, we start a to-go program, we get a couple guys in the kitchen, we're doing some basic, you know, sandwiches. We find some MEMA, the emergency management group, and a couple of the banks doing the PPP loans. They need food, so we start doing some disaster feeding. And then before you know it, we're doing neighborhood delivery. We create a website. We send a link to an HOA, homeowners association. They send it out to their homeowners. Wednesday, Bravo's coming to our neighborhood. Here's the menu. Order and pay. They'll bring it to you. We take it to the clubhouse. We put it in the back seats of people's cars. We built, got the dining room back open, yada, yada. When I sat there at the 3 days that I didn't know what the hell was going to happen, I said to myself, I'm broken. I have totally leaned my ladder against the wrong tree. I've worked my entire life for nothing. So as I came back to this, that's when all of a sudden I started going to a therapist, I started going to marriage counseling, and I started going to AA. And it was asking for help.
Wait, you started going to AA 20 years after your last...
I went, when I first stopped drinking, I did some meetings, and it wasn't for me.
Because
very different. It's a very different journey.
So you told that story about all the drinks you had, the wine, the scotch, and the frosty beer. Yeah. That was in 93.
97.
Thank you. Yeah.
So then
did you not drink for...
Not a drop.
And you never went to AA. And then you started going back to AA.
Because I found out, and this is the thing about AA, this is the thing about recovery. I always heard that it was always about booze. You go to an AA meeting, everybody talks about booze. It's not about booze.
What is it about?
The whole.
Yeah.
It's ego. About the whole. It's about the whole, the ego. It's about learning how to be vulnerable and talking to other people. It's about listening to other people. It's about caring. It's about listening to somebody else's concerns. It's about asking for help. And, you know, and a meeting is a one-hour format. It's pretty – but after the meeting, you know, and the friends you make – and actually, I went through the steps. And it was remarkable. And it was one of those times I had this guy's a lawyer who's my sponsor. He saw things in me and he helped me see things in myself that no one could have told me what he told me.
What did you learn about yourself?
That I have five basic defects. I am a control freak. I am insecure. I have a little bit of self-loathing. I have an anger problem. And I'm... Did I say insecure?
Yes.
What am I missing? Come on, Jeffrey.
Insecure, self-loathing, anger.
I'm conceited.
Conceited.
Yeah. Insecure, conceited, self-loathing, control freak. It's an absolute Janus coin, back and forth, two sides of the coin. Makes no sense. And so now I work every day on trying to understand that. And what I found is a lot of the skills that I have, unbelievable work ethic, ability to communicate, ability to steer someone to an outcome. Well, there's manipulation and then there's
persuasion.
Collaboration. And I would much rather be a collaborator now. So I try to watch myself and make sure I'm not manipulating. But you know what? Still got shit to get done. We still got the work. I got to tell somebody, you know, hey, can we grab a broom and sweep up out here.
Right.
You know, so.
But that was constant gentle pressure. Perfect example.
Perfect example of Danny Meyer.
I wouldn't have seen anger. I didn't see anger. No. It was just, hey, like, is this the Bravo way? Yeah. I don't think it is. Yeah. And like, let's remind people of
but what you know, and there is. And there's a real problem with the generation we have now that there really is a complete disjoint for understanding that we're at a job, and that part of the job is you are trading your autonomy for money and experience. I always understood that when I worked. I give up my rights to earn this and learn this.
Is it their fault?
No, I don't know that it's their fault, no. But it's the reality of it.
I mean,
I'd love to hear what your opinion. You've talked to a lot of people.
I don't think it's their fault. I think we are all products of the world we came up in. You know, like we are just a byproduct of the generation before us. You know, and it's weird because I think it comes full circle because it's usually the youngest generation that changes things, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But we it's nature and nurture, right? Like nature is what it is, but nurture, like we can only they are that way because of the generation that came before them.
Yep.
Is that not fair?
Absolutely.
I don't know. Like
my wife's a classics instructor. She oftentimes goes back to Roman text and she'll talk about, you know, Cicero saying that this generation is going to be the end of the world, you know? So yeah, I get it.
Yeah. So,
but I'm sure as you're talking to restaurateurs though, that I'm sure they, if they talk about their current problems, that labor.
Right.
Yeah.
But at the same time, look what's happening in the industry right now. Would you say it's transforming in the sense of post-pandemic work-life balance?
Oh, yeah.
People getting paid more in the restaurant industry?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. People, fundamental shift.
The lot of things that were status quo in the restaurant industry are kind of going away.
Absolutely.
And is that a bad thing?
It's a good thing for human beings. It's a good thing for our community. It's a good thing for the workforce. The questions become, how sustainable is it for the businesses? Because we truly worked a model that was based on wages in a certain way, things being a certain way. So it's different now. So I think there's a real, I don't want to say reckoning sounds really.
I think it's almost
negative,
like a, right?
But there's a evolution.
Yeah.
An evolution, perhaps, is that a fair thing to say?
Well, evolution for sure. But I think we're kind of at the point of the conversation now where we're talking about where the industry is today and where we're going, right? But I mean, I'll go there. I think at the same time, it's a very inconvenient truth that things have to change, you know. And it's just like, what's going to change? We have to. The pressure's on the industry to take care of its people, to provide opportunity for the people, to provide security for the people. But where does that come from? And I think it has to come from the consumer. It has to come through conscious capitalism of where are you putting your money. How many streaming services do you have? Are you getting a new pair of shoes every month? How much does that freaking purse cost? Like, what really matters? Food is the most important thing. It's literally, we exist because of our ability to come together, to hunt, to gather, to feed, to love each other. It's the most intimate thing. And it's down at the bottom of the totem pole in terms of hierarchy and like just social status in terms of like, oh, you work in a restaurant? Pardon my language, fuck yourself.
Yeah,
you know, like, seriously, like, so like, what is more important? And I think we have to identify the importance that our industry has, especially going into the future, as we become more and more disjointed, as more and more is given to AI and automation. Guess who's going to be here? The restaurant industry. Guess who's going to need your support? The restaurant industry. So I don't know. That was kind of
I think we found our poster boy. I love it.
Well,
I don't mean to interrupt you, Eric. You're. I just want to say that was an extraordinary monologue, and I mean that. Oftentimes people say monologue in a negative way. That was extraordinary. Well, it's on film. I'm glad it is. We were there. When those two guys, not knowing if they would die if they came into the same room, because you know before the as we were going through no more than 100 people in a room, no more than 50 people in a room, no more than 25 people in a room, close your dining room, only take out, close your restaurant. We went through that entire shutdown process, right? We all remember. So we're all saying, are we going to die? Are we going to turn into dust, a drama strain, powder in our shoes? When I asked those two guys to meet me at the back door and bake bread with me, they showed up to feed other people. I think this, the nation, that 2019-2020 moment the nation really saw the critical workers. They saw the essential workers, the nurses, the garbage men, the restaurant folks.
Right.
And I think we saw that generosity. You're talking about that conscious capitalism. We saw that so much with tipping and with generous paying and whatever you need and patience. Oh, the line is long. Only half the dining room can be open because there's not enough folks. We fully understand that. We have slipped back into, you know, where we were. We're back to, I think that we're back to, we expect certain things to happen certain ways in all ways, whether we're on an 800 number trying to, you know, book a flight or get information on something, whether we're at the grocery store and we're just trying to, why can't you ring that up? Why doesn't that sticker work? Why do you have to go walk off to go talk to somebody?
I mean, I witnessed it downstairs when I was here getting my lunch before we got started. A guy came in and he had to wait for a few minutes because I think they remade the order because by the time he got here, it was cold. So they remade it or something along those lines. And he was upset that he had to wait. And it's just like,
well, at least we're making it.
But you guys made it right. Yeah. You know, like you refired it. So, anyway, I want to get back. I mean, I'm loving the conversation. I want to make that clear, but I want to make sure there's nothing in your evolution as a restaurateur. We kind of went from 1996.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
We jumped over your second restaurant. We got into some current day.
Yeah.
I mean, it was great advice, and I'm not upset that we went down that road.
Well,
but
I've got a few more things to bring us to current. So we opened 98 here. We opened a bakery delicatessen, and there wasn't a scratch bakery in town. So we do European-style breads. We have a Pavier deck oven, so four deck gas-fired, you know, oven. We have a Hobart rotary rack oven for pastry. We do 15, 16 types of pastry every morning. We do about 30 desserts. We do 14 types of bread. And we make sandwiches from those breads. We sell retail bread. And then we make soup, salad, quiche, pasta.
Yeah.
So round out the menu here. Counter service, community coffee pot, meaning, you know, you buy one cup of coffee and it's, you know, all day long.
Yeah.
People park out here with Wi-Fi. You mentioned, you know, you found out we were the first public location for Wi-Fi in Jackson, Mississippi. We had a microwave Wi-Fi system.
What year is that?
This is 1999.
Wow.
And it was a technology company here in Jackson that had created, it was called Air to LAN, L-A-N, and they had created a methodology to beam internet through a microwave series of towers, and they were located in downtown, and they needed to get a signal to North Jackson to a hotel.
And you're the tallest building.
And we're the tallest building in between. So I said, if we put an antenna here, we'll light up your building. I swear that those headaches I had. No, never mind. anyway, that was a. It was a interesting attempt at first third space. You know, the
but
idea
you didn't
of
charge
having
them.
A third space. No,
why not?
Charge customers?
Well, no, you didn't charge the company.
We didn't charge them because they gave us the Wi-Fi.
Yeah, and that was that. So were they gonna, like, how did that go down? Was it like, what do you want for us to be able to use your building to?
Yeah, just put an antenna up and then put the equipment in. And
could you have made money on that?
This equipment was super expensive. No money. We have to spend a penny.
No, but could you have made money on letting them use your building?
They ended up closing a year later. So,
well, I guess the point I'm trying to make is you said we're not going to charge you. We just want free Wi-Fi.
Yes.
And what was the thought behind that?
Okay. So I tend to be too generous. I'm in the hospitality industry. I guess that's what you're trying to drive at. You know, I probably should be a lot harder on deals. But, you know, we all felt as a building, we all wanted internet too. So the other part about this was it would give us internet for a computer.
It would also drive people here.
Yes, it's
marketing.
And if
where there's people, there's hungry people.
There's a logo of Banner Hall on the wall back here, the silhouette. We made a modification of it where we had a little antenna with, you know, looked like the RKO Studios thing. You know, the idea was it was novel. It's something we could talk about.
Yeah.
And I remember one of our investors here, kind of one of those old oil men, he was in the dining room one day saying, Jeff, we got a problem. You need to turn these tables. You got all these people here with these computers. They sit here and they sit all day. They drink your coffee and they don't buy anything. And it's been the best thing ever. I have pharmaceutical reps every morning group here, eat breakfast, and then walk out with sandwich trays.
Yeah. You mentioned it before, and I want to echo it, the third place.
Yeah, it's the third. We were third place before third places were cool.
Yeah. And again, back to the restaurant industry. Like, I think this industry is going to change the world because we're becoming so detached as a society. And I think that the pendulum always swings back. And I think when it's ready to swing away from the direction we've been going for the past 40 years, the restaurant industry is going to embrace that pendulum swing back. And it's going to be what brings people back together and helps
us. I love
it. Yeah. So, but back to your story. 1997, DUI, mm-hmm. And I thought there was going to be this coming a moment or this coming to moment where like everything changes, you find work life balance, well, you're giving your wife attention
happened,
again.
It happened later.
So you go for another
20 years,
23 years,
and,
really.
And it got better. I mean, it got a little bit better, you know. But I opened a third restaurant, Sal right. Mookie's, in 2007.
Okay.
So every time my wife would
always
say,
the bounce.
My wife would always say, the minute you have some time, you either join a community board, you do a project, or you open a restaurant. You know, what the hell? Why can't you just come home? So, but we've been married for 37 years. She's the most amazing woman in the world. She's put up with everything for me. We have twin daughters. They're 27. They're both well-adjusted, good kids, thanks to Debbie. I won. Yeah. I've won in the end. I'm only 60. It sounds like I'm so old. I got a whole life ahead of me. Every day is rich. The now, it is so rich right now. I'm so happy to be here with you doing this right now. I am the old Jeff would be thinking, what do I need to do now? What do I need to be? What's happening?
Oh my God, you sound like my life right now.
Dude, I'm totally right here.
I mean, I'm trying to be in the now, but I'm also driving across the country.
Yeah, you got some things ahead of you.
It's busy.
But so the only thing ahead of you is a meal at Brava. This is really a joy for me to take this walk back. And for those that are watching and have made it this far, what I would say is when we opened the third restaurant. By the way, this is kind of important because this is about resilience. We opened Broad Street $1.2 million to this total gut and remodel of this space downstairs.
Yeah, this building was here before Broad Street, I'm assuming.
This building was here. And there was a restaurant that failed, three different restaurants in the space we're in. So here's the story again. and we gutted it, got I want you to think about how much gas and power it takes. We have a full bakery and a kitchen. We undersized the kitchen so grossly. We made the kitchen tiny, and all of a sudden we're this deli. So within a month, we realized we had really screwed the pooch. Something had to happen. The kitchen had to get bigger. Ego, not asking questions, not thinking before jumping, said, because we had the guy who sold us our ovens actually came to work with us, and he was from Memphis, and he said, let me tell you how this bakery in Memphis did it. When they needed to grow, they set up a wholesale location, and then they started selling to all these places. They make $1 million. So instead of doing the right thing, which is just, let's add on to the building, push the bakery back a little bit, make a little more kitchen room, we dismantled everything we had just installed, took over a fallow kitchen inside of a hotel that they'd closed the kitchen down, and for 10 years had the worst 10 years of our lives, where Broad Street baked bread and pastry 12 to 18 hours before it ever hit the rack to be sold. And we had two businesses going, and nobody was happy, and nothing was great. And in order to work our way out of that, we said, well, we'll open two little kiosk locations for Broad Street downtown in little teeny spaces. We nearly went broke three times. And when we finally had a chance to expand here, bring it back home, because I've been at this for Broad Street, it's been 25 years, working on 26 years.
You're dropping a lot on me. Let me make sure I understand. So you have the original location.
Here.
Instead of expanding to...
Within a month, we realized something had happened. So 6 months into opening here. So in 1999, we, as they're running the antenna for the Wi-Fi, we're moving the equipment.
You go to a commissary kitchen?
Two exits down, we create a commissary kitchen.
Where you're making all of your bread there.
And in order to pay for it, we said, well, this is open up more retail locations to sell more bread. Plus, we had 24 accounts on wholesale. I lost my head baker. I had to start learning how to run the business. I ran the bread truck for 8 months. I got up at 2 a.m. to be at work at 3 a.m. I was going to bed at 7 p.m. I didn't know where I was. You know, this is, you know, sober, you know, just crazy stuff.
What's the lesson here?
If I would have asked, I never, ever, and my partner and I were together on this. We never took the time to ask What's the best solution here?
What would have been the best solution?
To add on to the back of the
building.
Which
you were going to do before.
No, we never were going to do it. We were afraid. No, because there was one conversation and the other shops here said, there's not enough parking. Don't take any parking spaces. Oh, my God. That was the stupidest thing in the world.
Oh, man. So, I mean, I'm loving everything you're giving to us. I mean, I'm loving. Did you say it was $2.7 million to open this location?
No. $1.2
million. $1.2
million.
Sorry. I'm a little dyslexic. I apologize.
That's okay.
$1.2 million. So you went from $500,000 to $1.2 million you had to raise in a period of 5 years. Mm-hmm. And you said you got into it before. You used the same approach where you offered stake in the business, this time you did it in front of a lecture hall?
So, yeah, instead of having to go one-on-one talking to people, we called all of our Bravo investors who were thrilled. They invited all their friends, and we were in the restaurant business. Yeah. We saw people all the time. For months, we said, we're going to open this restaurant, and by the way, if you were interested, I'll put you on the list to come listen to the show.
You gave 35% of profit or of stake to
investors.
We kept
35 to us, 65 to the investors.
Okay. Any other big, learning points, transformational moments for you during this time, between Broad Street and your next concept?
So the idea of chasing, when I told you about moving the bakery, opening retail, chasing revenue, we completely lost our way. Instead of simplifying, we went the wrong direction. Also, there were three of us, and you'll notice I'm talking past tense on everyone, but at that point in time, six years into the business, 1 year into this business, David made the decision, and he was a full one-third partner. David made a decision that this was not for him, and so he tendered his resignation.
Did he keep his equity?
So, no, because one of the things we did, I'm so glad we're here. You're gonna love this. Are you ready? You're gonna love this. One of the things we did when we were just three guys talking about this dream is we made a shareholder agreement before we ever sold the first share of the stock. So we had a partnership agreement between the three of us.
Thank you for
that. Said what would happen in the death of the business if one of us wanted to quit, if one of us became disabled, if one of us died, or if one of us were fired by the other two, this is what would happen. And what we said, to be very vulnerable and very, very honest, we said our accountant that we used would do a valuation of the business, a simple valuation. So we agree in writing ahead of time. Nobody's going to take us to court. We're not going to fight the stand. A simple valuation. We would give input. We would say, here's what we know. Here are the numbers. Here's what we think's going on. And we were all very amicable about this. He did a simple valuation, and we would buy out whatever that pro rata value was. We would create a 60-month note and pay over 60 months that value. So when David exited, there was no damage to the business because it really was taking what turned out to be less than his salary, and we just paid that out to him as a he was
so
making,
he basically retired. I mean,
bingo.
Yeah.
But after 5 years, it was done.
Mm-hmm.
But also the day he walked out, it was 50-50 ownership between the two of us. We just had debt. We had a loan. The equity went to the two of us and still our limited partners. And that's the other thing we did. We set up our business smart. Mangia Bene, the restaurant management group, Mangia Bene Incorporated is a subchapter S corporation that the three of us created on day one. Mangia Bene became the general partner, or if you're doing an LLC, became the managing member to the limited partnership or to the limited liability company. Because it wasn't Dan, David, and Jeff as individual general partners to the limited partnership, we were able to do whatever needed to be done. If somebody left over here, it didn't impact the partnership because the entity was still whole. If we had done it individually, there would be a whole sticky mess of what would happen.
Where did you know how to do this? Did you have lawyers get involved?
So two things happened. I did listen to somebody. So those oil men I told you about, how do you do it?
when they met, you know, Dan would come home. He came home like three times for three different presentations.
He was practicing law, wasn't he?
No, no, he was a chef. Remember?
Yeah, but
he wasn't a chef. You remembered the point I said he was going to be a lawyer. He worked as a paralegal for 3 months.
Yeah, but I feel like this stuff is basic in the world of law.
It is basic in the world.
So he must have.
Well, we all had business law.
Yeah.
We all took that. We're all business majors, yeah. So we had basic stuff.
Got it.
One of the oilmen took me aside after meeting Dan and David after one of our presentations, because Dan did come home a couple of times, and he said, boy, let me give you a piece of advice. You're going into business with brothers. Blood is thicker than friendship. You better protect yourself.
Yeah.
And that's great advice. I also knew that...
That's great acting, too.
Thank you very much. I'm available. I'll be here on Thursdays. Come back, try the veal. It was great advice. And so that led me to say, hey, guys, we need to do a partnership agreement. And, you know, we talked to a lawyer about how to do that. And in terms of that subchapter S corporation, we had a really smart lawyer. He was hungry. He was a private lawyer. He worked. He worked for free based on the fact that once we raised the money, he would get paid, which is really nice for him. You know, he got paid, but he believed in us, and he said, you know, if it doesn't work out, we'll deal with it.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
You'll be my indentured servant. But he was the one that said, you really need to think about this methodology.
Yeah, you're dropping gold on us.
So as I drop gold, I'm going to fast forward to a year ago, March the 7th, which was the date that Dan and I signed the paperwork where Dan turned over his 50% to me.
Okay. I was curious. I knew it was going to come out eventually, but I wanted it to happen organically. So you're the sole owner.
I'm now a sole owner.
How's that feel?
Overwhelming.
Well, what did your partners handle that you now have to handle? Or once they gave up their lanes, how did you find people to fill those lanes?
So the first partner leaving year six, which was 24 years ago, that's long been absorbed. So I really can't speak to that. I'll just speak to the fact that we had a 50-50 partnership, Dan and I. He ran the kitchen, I ran the service and the business. So what I had to absorb was I was now responsible for the kitchen. I'm not a chef.
Did he have anybody behind him?
Yeah, and my corporate chef was the guy behind him.
Got it.
And so John and I are just like this. And so let's be, again, really honest and vulnerable and truthful. And I don't think I'm saying anything that either Dan or David hopefully would ever take issue with if and when they watch this. The pandemic, so again, David's 24, we're 24 years past, so we're just talking about Dan. The pandemic took us all down. Dan was a chef, a working chef, and his body was grinding away at him.
Yeah. I mean, you guys have been going at it the same amount of time, but the kind of work he was doing versus the kind of work you were doing.
Right.
And our
genetics are different.
Yeah.
You know, and he was really just physically, it was wearing him down. When COVID hit, the light went out. It was one of those moments. He said, you know something, I don't have it.
There's nothing wrong with retiring at the age of
60. 60? No, 59, 60. There's
you work,
nothing
that's
wrong
why
with it.
You bust your ass.
Yeah.
So you can have something to, and I'm sure between the equity that these three businesses have at this point, you built it up, you cash out, you get that, like he gets 50% of or whatever.
50% of what we had. Understand right. That two of our businesses also had investors, et cetera. So, you know, it's an iterative process. But the thing here is this. And this is the gold, if you will, to share the meaningful bit. Dan didn't come to me and say he wanted to retire. We were really getting to be in an impasse. There was a lot of stress. There was a lot of things we had to accomplish. We need to move forward. We need to get these things done. We need to, and he was a bit of feet of clay oftentimes, and I was getting more and more frustrated. And here I am working on myself, trying to be, you know, and what I ended up doing is I did follow what I was told to do, ask questions. I started asking other people for their opinion. I said, I've got this situation. My partner just doesn't want, and we've got things we need to do. And so everyone suggested, they said, you need to offer to buy him out, let him go. And I'm like, he won't, this is,
can't do that.
Yeah.
This is his identity. He right. created these three restaurants. Right. They're his menus. They're his babies. He named every one of them.
Right. His DNA is.
You can't, we can't do this. And they said, then just do the right thing. So, you know, do whatever you feel is right. So I really worked hard. I asked a lot of questions. I started putting a business plan together because that's something I do well. If I can put it on paper and look at it and believe in it, I can sell it. So I came up with something that I really believe was equitable, was fair, made sense. Overly generous, like the Wi-Fi guy. Didn't charge him for the antenna. Yeah. I threw in some other things because Dan deserved to be honored. He created these things. And then I printed out that plan twice. And I have a little binder at the office, a little one of those binding machines. I put a little honeycomb binder in it. And it had a little front page. And it said, Our Future. And I took those two copies and I stuck it in my briefcase. And I carried it around with me. And I said, my deadline is X. And every day, I didn't do anything. And I started to become anxious. And I said, X is going to come and I'm not going to do it. I don't know what I'm going to do. And then we had a meeting with at Sal Mickey's. We had a manager meeting and the things were tough and difficult conversations and the meeting breaks. And we both stand up and he looks at me and he says something. And I don't remember what it was, but he said something and it was so different than what he usually says. And I said, that's it. That's the moment I've been waiting for. And I said, can we talk? And we sat down.
So you're looking for the opening.
And I said, I've been thinking a lot about our future and I got some ideas, but I need your help. And I shared the plan. And I said, I don't want you to open this. I want you to take this home. He called me a couple hours later and he was in tears. And he said, this is what I've been waiting for. So what I can tell you is this. We oftentimes get so caught up in what we think is going to happen, we're afraid to have the conversation. And what ended up happening was the right thing, doing the right thing, was to do exactly what happened. It's a year later, he is free and is not, you know, it's so interesting. I ask myself oftentimes, I say, could I be as healthy as he is, detached from this business? Because I would just be so compulsive about it. And I'd be sending him texts and saying, I had eggs that weren't right. But so it's been lovely. And to show full circle, my wife now works in this restaurant with me.
That's cool.
So my wife is helping me. Our problem child is Sal Mickey's, an amazing, successful business that we moved 14 years into our original location. We moved to a new location over the district, this wonderful development just down the street. It's a huge restaurant with a lot of employees, a lot of transactions, family style. And the bottom line is, I need help. And she is right there, bussing tables, leading, guiding, and directing, part-time, doing the school teacher. She retired from teaching, but she's a school teacher in there, communicating with these kids, leading and guiding and directing in a direct way. And I'm so happy that we're sharing that now because I always kept that away from her. Mm-hmm. So now I have to learn that she calls me 3 or 4 times a day and she says, just want to let you know. And I need to not be snarky and say, well, I'm kind of busy right now. I could have found that out later. Anyway.
Jeff, I'm loving the conversation, man. Really, this has all been gold. One more quick break to thank our sponsors and we'll be right back to start talking about where you are today and where we're going. Okay. This podcast is made possible by Restaurant Systems Pro, and we need to let you know that every second and fourth Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, CEO of Restaurant Systems Pro, Fred Langley, will be going live where he'll cover what you need to know about running a profitable restaurant from soup to nuts. This live event will reveal the steps to manage the service and financial goals for your restaurant's productivity. Everyone who attends this live event will get a recording of the Restaurant Systems Pro 4-day How to Run a Profitable Restaurant from Soup to Nuts recording. This event costs $2,500 to attend live, and you'll get it for free. Head to go.restaurantsystemspro.net/restaurantunstoppable. That's go.restaurantsystemspro.net/restaurantunstoppable. This episode is brought to you by Restaurant Technologies, Inc. RTI's Total Oil Management automates your entire cooking oil process. With Total Oil Management, you get dependable fresh bulk cooking oil delivery, filtration plus oil usage monitoring and reporting, easy oil disposal, used cooking oil pickup and recycling, and say goodbye to those messy, dangerous restaurant rendering tanks. Yuck.
RTI's end-to-end cooking oil system helps you manage your used cooking oil disposal, storage, collection, and recycling conveniently, safely, and cleanly with no upfront cost. RTI's services are not limited to oil. They also provide insurance premiums and automated hood cleaning solutions, plus hood filtration systems, making your hood cleaning process easy, automatic, and worry-free. In addition to all this, Restaurant Technologies, Inc. can help you reduce your carbon footprint, which we all know is becoming increasingly more important to the consumer. Restaurant Technologies, Inc. is always on, so you don't have to be. To learn more, head to RTI-Inc.com and let them know Restaurant Unstoppable Podcast sent you their way.
We're back, and you know, we covered a lot today. We kind of jumped all over the place, but gold was falling out in every direction we turn. So, and you're just a natural speaker, man. So I kind of just let you go do your thing. There wasn't much interviewing as you just kind of like tearing. And that's just a testament to your, I think your ability to sell, right? And you have an amazing story to sell, and you sold it. But now I kind of want to get to where we are today, where your businesses are today. We identified that you've sold your shares. Are you
I bought my partner shares.
Thank you. Yes. You bought your partner shares. Is there any other detail around that in terms of like how to set it up? You said you alluded that you were very generous.
Yes.
So without giving out too much, because it's Dan's private information.
It's private information. What I did, I asked our accountant that we'd worked with for years. I mean, the same guy that did the valuation way back with David. I said, hey, can we, you know, here's what I'm thinking. Somewhat sensitive because you work for Dan and me, but I'm asking you about whether you could give me a valuation, and I'll be responsible for paying for this myself, to help me figure out what the business may be valued, because I'm going to offer Dan, I think, an opportunity to. And he goes, first of all, I think it's a great idea, because I'm watching you guys from the outside. I think that, so he's another person who's saying, I think you're right, Jeff. Right. I think this is a good idea. So he gave me a financial model. And then I could take a look at that and say, okay, this is the money. Now, here's the money we have, the money that I have, the money I need to figure out how I'm going to pay him. So in a nutshell, I was able to give him 80% of the value that we agreed to, and then did a 30-month note for the other 20%. And the proposal I gave him, he came back with one counterproposal, and he was spot on. He took the work to a good friend of his who is a CPA, one of his best friends from college. They talked about it, and they found a mistake in not what our accountant did, but a mistake in the fact that we were using, in the look back, we used a pandemic year, and it skewed the amount of money that was lost versus made in PPP, stuff like that. So yeah, you just had to smooth it out. So it changed the number a bit. And that was absolutely just. What I will tell you is, by doing this honorably, the day that I sat down with Dan and gave him that plan, and he called me a couple hours later and said, this is what I've always been waiting for. I was waiting to be freed. It was 5 weeks to us signing the paperwork, shaking hands, and him walking out the door. And the only lawyer that was involved was the lawyer who wrote up the legal transactions. Wow. That had to be written up. And the work that had to be done was, I worked tirelessly to ensure that every single contract, I mean, you have to think about this, every broadliner, your Cisco, US Foods, Roma, Benny Keith, anyone you're working with, there's a personal guarantee on that. Your lease, your bank account, I had to extract him from every single one. Some of the folks have said, hey, no problem at all. You know, it was done. You know, I need you to send me a letter to that. Okay. Others are like one of our leases, it had to go through corporate. It had to come back around. All of a sudden, what's the problem? Is there a problem here? You know, so you have to go through that whole process. Right. And did it honorably, did it detailed, did it the way I do things, and we got it done.
Nice. So, what's interesting is I've noticed that today, if I'm opening a restaurant, I don't think I could do it alone. Yeah. I think it's the opening a restaurant today is not the same as it was in the early 90s, right? But ironically, you chose how to open a restaurant that the way I would do it today, you chose to do that back in the 90s. And now today, you're the sole proprietor.
Kind of the last man standing, you know? Last man standing,
so
kind of
backwards,
story.
Yeah, you know?
Yeah. I could not ever have done this without Dan or David.
Right.
They could not have done this without me. It took all three of us. The whole journey we're on, everything that's happened has brought us to here. Because we, each time, I think we're super, we've always been a good culture, honest organization. It's only natural that we didn't end up in some kind of protracted fight.
Right.
We didn't end up with you know, lawyers fighting each other and he said, she said. We ended up doing the right thing.
Yeah. So I guess where I was going with this train of thought is, now you had all the support partners.
So now I don't. Okay.
Now you're on your own.
Okay. Infrastructure.
Infrastructure.
So I've got John, the corporate chef. I've got Tanya Burns, my chief operating officer. Tanya was with us for 18 years, ran Bravo. Amazing talent. Came to me a year ago, right? 3 months before I ever started thinking about the thing with Dan, came to me and said, you know, I'm going to take, it's been a long time. I really appreciate it. Got three kids, tired of the restaurant business. I'm going to take a job with this liquor company. I'm going to be a rep. And she called me back 8 months later. The buyout had happened. So this was December. She tells me that a year ago. Buyout happens last March. She calls me August of last year and says, I'd like to meet with you.
So buyout meaning you paid your 30 months of paying out.
No, just the transaction, selling the transaction.
But you said 30 months.
I am in the 30 months. I'm almost halfway through.
I was
going to
say, because that was at the end of the, it was
just a year. It was
two and a half year period. Right.
So we still got 15, 16 months to go. So what I mean is that she saw that I'd taken the business over myself. She's doing her thing, selling liquor. She came back to me and she said, this has been an interesting experiment. I'm doing really well, but I'm not happy doing this. You need help. I'd like to offer myself to be, and she understands our business well. She said, I know John is handling the kitchens. You need somebody to handle the restaurants. That'll be me. Because you need to have support. So the way it'll work is you're going to need to pay me well, but I'm going to earn it. And then we're going to need to think about what's next, because you're going to have one more layer of income at some point in time for the long run for us all to be able to do this together. So she was very forward-thinking in that. Scared the hell out of me when she says, do something more.
Right. So she's operations.
Right.
You are today. What is your role?
So when I say operations, she's actually in the restaurant. She's running shifts, running floors, lead, guide, direct, teaching people what to do. She's doing the grunt work of recalibrating our management team, making sure standards are being held.
Got it.
So so what do? I help with that.
Yeah.
I am the keeper of all forms. I am the fixer of all things. I'm the guy who's got all the phone numbers. I'm the guy who understands the equipment. So I'm an ombudsman. And also I'm the guy who is saying, tomorrow morning at 7 a.m., my wife and I are driving down to New Orleans. We're going to Hogs for the Cause. We're going to be gone this weekend. Yeah. Well, I'm the guy who said a couple months ago, I'm going to Iceland for a week.
You use a word. You're the what guy? The
ombudsman.
What's
the guy
that?
The guy who does everything. He's the journalist.
Jack
of all trades, master of none.
Got it.
If you go open the trunk of my car, my SUV, you'll see nothing but tools back there. It'll come out. Come time to play golf, I'll pull my out again. but literally, so I came back from Oxford. I did that speech up there last night. Came back this morning. Pulled into the parking lot of right after lunch at Sal when I got into town. Took out a drill, took out duct tape, and took out some screws. Walked in. I had a carpenter build this new cabinetry set. They explained to me on the phone what was wrong with it. I walked in, sank three screws, did a duct tape thing, did this, and walked off.
And I'm assuming the third salary is going to be culinary.
Well, so I've got the culinary. Yeah, that's John, the culinary. So John and I reworked the menu here. We reworked the menu at Bravo, and we're in the process of reworking the menu at Sal. So we made fundamental changes the first time that it wasn't a Dan change, and I did some things I wanted to do. I wanted hot griddled sandwiches here. Dan didn't want to do that. We got a griddle. We're doing hot griddled sandwiches.
I almost ordered one of those things. I'm trying to stay away from the sandwiches.
Oh, there's a fatty boy special. That chimichurri with beef is mighty good. I wanted to take a step back into some simple, authentic, very, very Italian pieces over at Bravo. And so we did that. Plus, I wanted to give the chef that had been there for 20 years working with us the chance to put his fingers on the menu. So he did some things I never would have done.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, along this line of, like, now you were three, you're one.
Right.
With people that you've put into position.
I know what to say, yeah.
What's that?
I know you.
I've had to democratize my business.
Okay.
I have. So when we get back to workers and everything else, I think that I'm a little bit maybe ahead of the curve. I've democratized. I also gave a shit ton of raises right off the bat. We were tight on money. And I saw in the kitchens, I saw the guys were not making what they should make.
Oh,
and
yeah,
so
yeah.
I liberalized all of the pay, believing that I was going to, because my so far so true, it's I've lived to see tomorrow. I believe that tomorrow is going to be a better day. I've had some really tight months.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned earlier, I think, what was it, $11 million between the three concepts? What in your best years, all cylinders running, what was the best percent profit you had?
So the difficult part about taking the percentage profit is this. We charge a corporate overhead to each restaurant that goes to pay for my office staff and pays us. So that 7% of everything kind of goes over there. So the businesses, they get a chunk taken out of them that affects the bottom line.
Yeah, you're also got owner's pay that you're paying.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So when you try to put all that back together, it gets a little hard. What I will say to you is this. I have found that running for me, and we run a little bit fat on staffing. If I'm lucky to make 5 to 8%, that's we're doing really well.
But you're also paying yourself a salary.
We've already paid ourselves before that's if we make 5 to 8% of the bottom line, we're doing really well.
Right.
There are plenty of months that it's that. But as I say,
you put a zero up for
when
they
say a zero, I say we paid all our bills.
Yeah.
I got paid, you got paid. The best part is when we make $1. We have a bonus structure and everybody gets bonused. And I'm like, it's a good thing.
You're also paying 20% of what you owe Dan right now, too. So I feel it's going to get better.
And that's going to get better.
Yeah.
It's like any loan. You're paying off a loan. Once you can pay it off, you feel better.
So where I'm going with this is, like, as we move into the future, they say you're going to have to start doing a lot more with less. Mm-hmm. Meaning you're going to have to, like, if you're not integrating technology into your business, if you're not leaning on automation, if you're not investing in a certain level of technology, tech stack, whatever you want to call it, like, where, as somebody who's been around since the 90s, mm-hmm. right? Coming from NCR, mm-hmm. knowing the importance of technology, mm-hmm. how are you evolving your business to kind of be ready for this boom of AI in automation? Like, what are you doing to stay relevant?
My controller has been with me since day one. She was the first hire. We hired her in July of 1993. We opened in April of 94. She is 2 years older than me. She just became a grandmother. Tick. She is the person who is she is the keeper of all accounting information. She has two people that work with her. Our HR person who does all payroll and a part-time person that helps with filing and input. She's going to retire. It's going to happen. We both are older and we are set in our ways, and she is set in the way she does things. She had a CPA license. She let that, she didn't sit, when she came to work with me, she didn't bother keeping it up. But she's coming from that level of sophistication. Automation is key for my accounting. So, we've struggled mightily with point of sale to general ledger interfacing. We've struggled mightily with, right now we're trying to work on automated payment. So we're gonna have all of our invoices. We have a lot of them are already EDI, getting electronic invoices, but the ones that are paper, scanned OCR to automatic posting into payables, and then filling inventory counts, pricing, so we can get correct inventory sheets. Maybe someday we'll get to recipe costing. We don't do recipe costing. We do it by hand. We put something together. We know our food costs based on our monthly financials. Did we make food costs or we didn't make food costs? And if we see the trend going the wrong way, we say, where is it? But we don't do the thing where we're going to do the menu change at Broad Street. Let's price out all the things. I wonder how much that's going to cost. We have a good feel.
Yeah.
But we do right now, we do a spreadsheet inventory. Once a month, we have an Excel spreadsheet. You clear out the count. You blank out the count column to make it blank. You put it on a notepad. And you walk through and you take count, you key it back in, you send it to me, I approve it and send it to her, she puts the cost of goods in. We aren't pulling that information from the point of sale. We aren't pulling an automated sheet out. We're not doing as much automation on that side. And those are things we've got to do. And the busyness of the business doesn't always allow us to spend the time to do that.
Right.
And I'm
it's
not
a real,
big,
it's a real challenge.
Yeah. And so when you're a single operator or a couple operating or just a couple guys doing it and you're still doing the business, you don't have time for butt time in an office to noodle on how that's going to work.
Right.
And I've, you know, and you know, I've written the manuals, I've done the training manuals, you know, are we using the training manuals? Well, that training manual doesn't work anymore. And nobody told me that, you know, who's going to make the new one? Well, we're too busy. We're thin, you know, we've tried a new scheduling software, we're trying to get the scheduling software to work at the point of sale. And the worst part about technology is that everyone says they interface, and yet it never works.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
There's always that, you know, just that slight.
Yeah, there's a couple companies out there right now who are getting real close. I'm going to use this opportunity to talk about Restaurant Systems Pro. I don't know if you saw that logo on the side of my
Tell camper. Me about it. Come on.
But man, they're so close. I think that, they're going to be, as far as my knowledge goes, the only fully integrated technology stack from POS to general ledger to inventory management to AP to AR to scheduling, all under one roof, fully integrated. And I'm telling you right now, if I'm opening a restaurant tomorrow, I'm going with Restaurant Assistance Pro because I hate technology and I want to have one partner that is constantly evolving under one roof, because I think a solid system for everything that's constantly evolving is better than picking and choosing, cherry picking all these different technologies that identify themselves as best in class, but don't talk to each other, that don't integrate.
I appreciate that.
So talk to Robert St. John. He took the jump over to Restaurant Assistance Pro.
You're kidding me.
No, he did. After
Shut
listening
the
to this
front
podcast.
Door.
Yeah. So talk to him. He's a guy that I think what I understand, he's had an extreme amount of success in a short period of time. So
holy cannoli.
Yeah. So happy to make that introduction.
I appreciate you telling me that. And I appreciate them sponsoring you. So I had a chance. You know, you're bringing me a little gold there, my friend.
So fortunate to have them in my corner.
That's great.
But I know there's some things you want to talk about before we wrap up. And the mission statement is to inspire, empower, and transform the industry. But really what we're here to do is change the world through transforming the industry. And you said some things off air that are near and dear to your heart. You said you want to work on your community. Yep. What does that look like?
Yeah, I'm in a broken community here. The young people that I hire that are Jacksonians, many of them would not have the opportunity to eat in the kind of places they're working. So, if I think about a young high school kid from, a South Jackson public high school, and he's coming to work with me, he's 15 years old and he's going to be a busboy or be a cashier. And, he's coming to work with us and we're sharing orientation and we're saying, you know, our goal is to give good service. So be sure to go give good service. Go give good service. What is good service to that young man? What is his understanding of good service? Because when he eats out, he might eat out at a fast food restaurant with himself or family, perhaps his, and then based on the location in town, that restaurant may be the worst example of that restaurant chain in the city. You know, it's the one with the milkshake machine that never works. It's the one with the, you know, the drive-through window.
I think you're painting the picture.
So now I'm telling him, give good service.
It's relative.
I have to be able to explain and do that in a way that's relevant and not, I can't talk down to this human being. I have to be able to connect with. So it's a real art form to do that. And then there's also a deeper level I've come to understand, and this is where I really want to try to help humanity. Oftentimes, in dysfunctional environments, young people and people in their 20s are in abusive or just dysfunctional situations at home. And so in order to survive, they oftentimes have to front. They have to create personas or lie or white lie. They have to survive. You have to do things to survive. So if that becomes your muscle memory, to that you're quick to falsify or quick to
cover your ass.
Exactly. Then what happens when your workplace, when we ask you to be honest and do the right thing and tell the truth? So I have to really understand that sometimes I have to show what telling the truth looks like. And I have to also have a work environment when somebody tells me the truth about me or our workplace, that I have to accept that and I have to show
care to what I'm hearing. Because if I say, I want to hear your comments and I want to know all about it, and then you tell me something, I'm like, oh, screw you.
Yeah, how fast are you going
to... Do you know who you're talking to? I've been doing this for 30 years, young man. So it's an interesting balance, but it's all about understanding that we're all human beings and everyone comes from a different place. And the difference from today, from 20 years ago in the restaurant business, or 10 years ago, is there was always a line of people out that door for that job. So the narrative and the metric was a little different. It's like, you don't like it? I'm sorry, man. You don't like, but now it's like, you don't like it? Let's talk about why that is and what we can do. It's a real, and you know what? Thank God that I can be that person, because I want to be that person to care, because I want to be a person that cares about that person where someone else may not be caring for that person.
Right.
So maybe that's the mission in our industry. Maybe that's part of it. You know, we don't live in an immigrant society here in Jackson, but where you're from in the Northeast, you guys have all sorts of immigrants from all over. And what care and concern can restaurants are the place where people can wash dishes and not speak English, and then all of a sudden you're an anchor for somebody in their family, right, to be able to move forward.
Well, we were talking earlier, and we were just saying, like, I think I said that it's not their fault, right?
No, exactly.
And like, they are a byproduct of the world they came in.
Nature, nurture.
And they came up in a world that's more disconnected, disjointed, in a silo than ever before. Mm-hmm. I think now, when did the iPhone come into existence? 2007? What year is it today? 2024? We're almost 20 years.
Yeah, and they don't know anything.
They're 15
different.
Years old. So when they were 5 years old, they got thrown with an iPhone in their face. Now they're entering into the workforce. And we are the reason. It's like what happened over the past 60 years with our food system. It took 40 years for us to be the beneficiary of a broken food system, and there was no benefit to it. Yep. We're all sick. We can't even eat bread anymore. Yep. And it happened slowly. But this thing with the technology and the... in living in a silo, these echo chambers, and just like letting the internet raise your children, you know, like there's no social emotional intelligence. We haven't given the people the skills they need to be able to do this. Yep. And it's totally on us. And I say us because, I mean, if I had a kid when I was 18 years old, I would have children who are about 18 years old now, you know? So I don't have any kids, but if you're about my age or a little bit older and you did a shitty job raising your children, well, guess what? We have to come together and provide these people. We have to stop. I don't know. Like, we need technology. That's not going anywhere. I'm not an anti-technology person, but I think that we have to remember what it means to be human.
Yeah.
And we have to inject. But back to this mission statement, to inspire, to change the world by inspiring, empowering, and transforming the industry. The reason why I think the restaurant industry can do it is because of people like you. It's a ripple out. If you want to be unstoppable in the restaurant industry, it starts with you lifting yourself up and then lifting up those around you. And if every restaurant owner across the country starts lifting up their team, empowering their team, teaching their team, giving them the standards, then the world will change, because those people are going to turn around and do it for the next.
Yep.
And that's why I think that the restaurant industry is the last leg we have to stand on.
That would be known as a mic drop moment, my friend.
Right?
How inspiring it is to meet you and to have a chance to spend this evening with you talking. You have absolutely made me think, made me feel, and you've actually given me a couple actionable things I need to do, not the least of which is look at restaurant operations. Thank you.
Thank you, man. This has been a lot of fun. A couple more questions. Just two or three more. We'll be wrapped up in like 5 minutes. I know you probably are itching to get back to your restaurant. I've been over here.
I may go home.
So the mission statement again is to change the world by inspiring, empowering, and transforming the industry. But if we're going to change the industry, we've got to change one restaurant owner at a time. So how have you personally transformed? Who are you today versus the man you were when you got started?
Well, I'm a lot more self-aware. Really self-aware of the wake that I leave. I leave a big wake. I take a lot of oxygen out of the room.
Yeah.
And I have a lot of power, And I just need to be really mindful of how I'm using that. And I need to be quick to apologize when I've overstepped my boundaries. But I also need to not be a doormat. I need to be able to stand up for what I believe in, what's right. I need to hold standards, constant general pressure. Thank you, Danny Myers. That's the best thing in the world. That, you know, that book, Setting the Table, is a must read for any restaurateur.
Yeah. What is one thing about you, your business, a value, a process, a system that's truly uncommon and makes you unstoppable?
Wow, that is a fantastic question. This is so basic, but I think it's a great example. Many, many, many years ago, this guy was in my wedding. I waited tables with him. Both Dan and I waited tables with him early in our career as restaurateurs. He was our broadliner rep, so he was our sales rep. So he's a buddy. He was our broadliner rep, and he comes to us, and I'm walking through the kitchen, and he's got Dan at the table, and he's got his those old clunky laptops up, and he's got the laptop up, and he's showing this picture of these soups, and he's got this price list, and he's saying, "So look, if I just sell 30 more cases of this soup, I go to the Caribbean. Dan, you got to help me out." And Dan's like, "I can't help you here." He goes, "Dan, I know, come on, man, just buy the soup. Nobody will know the difference." And Dan said, "Absolutely, everyone will know the difference, because the minute I buy canned soup and I hand it to the guys here in the kitchen and say, 'This is good stuff, don't worry about it, just open it up and put it in the soup tureen, we're going to sell it,' I've just violated the entire ethos of our business."
Culture.
So the culture we've built is to be honest and to be truthful about what we do. And so product integrity, people integrity, pay integrity, and also when a customer complains, we over-respond to the benefit of the customer. We don't denigrate our customers. Yeah. And you know what? I haven't gone broke yet.
Yeah.
Yet.
So this is the last big question before I have you call somebody out. If you got the news, you'd be leaving this world tomorrow. All the memories of you, your work, and your restaurants lost with your departure, except for three pieces of wisdom that you can leave behind for the good of humanity and your legacy. What are those three pieces of wisdom?
Check the candles. Make sure they're blown out before you walk out of the room.
One.
Check the candles. pay your bills on time.
Two.
The only power you have with a vendor is to pay your bills. It's really not that important. What you think is important really isn't that important.
Right. This has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much, Jeff. Who do you respect and admire? So Robert St. John put me in touch with you. Thank you, Robert.
Yeah.
Who is out there who you just respect, admire? You know they're killing it. They're profitable. They're fiscally responsible. They have a great culture. They're making opportunity for others. They're shattering the status quo. Who comes to mind as I say these things?
When I was down fetching you a cup of coffee earlier, I ran into a young lady in line, and she kept on looking at me, and then she walked up to me and she said, "I really want to meet you. I've heard so much about you. I know who you are. My name's Kat. I'm a bartender at Char. I've been there for 3 years. I've heard so much about you, and I just watched what you had to say. That you're really a neat guy." And I said, "That's really kind of you, Kat. I appreciate that. You know, and you enjoying work? Yeah, I love it," and everything. So some people would immediately start reaching into their wallet. "Here's my card." Instead, I said, "How's David doing?" And she goes, "Oh, he's so great." I said, "David Kahn is one of the finest people, most detail-oriented people, and successful business people I know. David Kahn, C-O-N-N, is one of the owners of Char, Amerigo, Sombra, Jasper's, Saltine, a fabulous Mississippi-based chain family of restaurants that is based in Mississippi, Nashville, and Atlanta. It's an interesting..." Or Memphis, excuse me. Memphis, Nashville, and Jackson.
I think he's been recommended before.
David lives here, and he's a real sharp guy, and he has some great restaurants here. And they have scaled very large through a network of partners.
That's the future.
He's got a fascinating story about where they came from. Literally out of bankruptcy, where the managers that were told, "This business is now bankrupt. You no longer will have a job. We're going to try to work our way through it." They turned around. They bought the business out of bankruptcy, and they've grown to phenomenal sites. If you're talking about somebody I admire in the restaurant business, I don't have to do anything further than walk down the steps and across the parking lot at Bravo to Char Restaurant and see David Kahn. He's great. Absolutely fantastic.
David, look out. I'm coming after you. I'd love to get you on this show. And I see why you're in sales, man, because you just sold the shit out of David Kahn. And I'm hoping I can make this happen while I'm in the neighborhood. And how can we connect if we were inspired by today's story? We want to reach out to you, maybe join your team or follow up on something they might share.
I appreciate that. So the name of my restaurants, it's Bravo Italian Restaurant and Bar, not affiliated with the chain. We actually predate them. So Bravo Italian Restaurant, Jackson, Mississippi. Broad Street Baking Company, Jackson, Mississippi. Sal and Mookie's New York Pizza and Ice Cream Joint. We never even talked about the fact that the name came from Do the Right Thing, the Spike Lee movie. Sal, the pizzeria owner. Mookie, the pizza delivery guy. Sal and Mookie's New York Pizza and Ice Cream Joint. If you were to Google those three names and go to the website and hit contact us, guess where that email goes? It goes to me. I'm also on Facebook, Jeff E. Good. You'll see it's me because it'll look like me. I'm available on Instagram at Jeff Good, 1234. What a creative tag that is. But the bottom line is, if you're looking for me, all you have to do is Google the name of our restaurant in Jackson, Mississippi, and it'll come right to me.
Jeff Good, thank you so much, my friend.
Thank you.
There is no questioning. You are unstoppable.
Thank you, man.
There's another episode wrapped up here at Restaurant Unstoppable. Special thanks to our guest today, Jeff Good, for coming on and being a shining example of somebody who's willing to give before they get. And I think that's one of the big takeaways I got from today's conversation, is this level of generosity in looking to give to your stakeholders and provide value to your stakeholders. And when you exist to serve, you are also taken care of. Eventually, you will be taken care of if you're playing the long game. And I think that really shone through in today's episode. So thank you so much, Jeff Good. This was awesome stuff. And as you are listening to this, I am in Arizona. We took about 2 weeks off from recording. I drove out from Louisiana, Mississippi area over a week, got out to the west, and then I spent a week with Restaurant Systems Pro, joining them for their quarterly meetup, which was hosted in Arizona, Phoenix, Arizona, at the Restaurant Systems Pro headquarters. And we're actually going to be getting Fred on the show real soon and going to be announcing some big news. So stay tuned for that. And I don't really know what the plan is going out from here. Honestly, the plan is to be present, honestly. That is the plan, to be present, to keep my ear to the ground, to let my current guest connect me with my next guest, and really to take a more journalistic approach. And I'll be honest, it's not easy slowing down. I'm so used to just trying to cram as much content or as much interviews into a short period of time. But being in the camper and really establishing the new normal this week, because really going forward, like I'm sticking around a city as long as I need to get the job done. I don't even know what that looks like yet. Is it 20 interviews? Is it 30 interviews? I don't know. But the theory is working out. You tap into a community, you tap into a network, and if you intend to do well, if you intend to give, if you intend to add value first, it just, people can smell that, and opportunities happen, doors open, and that's the game plan. I'd love to connect with you while I'm out west. Don't be shy. Reach out to me, Eric at restaurantunstoppable.com. Also, I want to say thank you to the people who make the show possible. Thank you to Jared Parisi for your copyright and editing and co-production, and thank you to Callan Miola for taking the bull by the horns and really helping me get clarity on what we're going to build into the future as we go forward. And I'm just so grateful for my team. That's it for today. Until next time, peace out.